Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the May 17th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Attorney General William Barr. He is riding some sort of fire-breathing, flying dragon creature. They're high up in the sky. You can see the U.S. Capitol in the background, and he's holding on with one hand, and with the other hand, he's got a raised fist with a defiant look on his face. And the title says, "Going to War, the Trump Administration's Refusal to Submit to Congressional Oversight." And that, I believe, is our first main story. Trump's war with congressional Democrats. What happened? The oversight battle between the White House and congressional Democrats escalated to a new level of ferocity this week as the Trump administration defied lawmakers' demands for access to a wide range of potentially damaging documents and witnesses. Trump invoked executive privilege for the first time in his presidency over the entire Mueller report to shield redacted portions and all the underlying evidence, which were subpoenaed by the House Judiciary Committee. After that decision, the Judiciary Committee voted to recommend that the full House hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for refusing to turn over those documents. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin also told House Democrats that he would not comply with their request for Trump's tax returns under a 1924 law that explicitly gives lawmakers the power to request any tax returns. Mnuchin claimed that such a request must serve a legitimate legislative purpose, accusing the Democrats of having none. The Trump family also filed lawsuits to keep Deutsche Bank and Capital One from complying with a House subpoena for bank records involving loans to their business. The Trump administration also instructed former White House counsel Don McGahn, who told special counsel Robert Mueller's team that Trump instructed him to fire Mueller and later to lie about that order, to refuse a subpoena to testify before and provide documents to the House Judiciary Committee. Trump also tweeted that Mueller himself should not be allowed to testify before Congress, contradicting an earlier statement from Barr that he would have no objection to Mueller testifying. Lawmakers and the Justice Department had been negotiating on a date for Mueller's testimony this month. "No redos for the Dems," Trump said. What the editorial said: "The Trump administration's stonewalling of Congress flies in the face of the Constitution," said the Washington Post. "Congress has a profound interest in robust executive branch oversight. It's not for the White House to decide what's fair game. The 1924 law, for example, flatly states that the Treasury Secretary shall furnish any tax return Congress requests with no qualifications. And let's not forget, Americans last year elected a Democratic House in part to act as a check on a wayward president. The real offense against the Constitution here is by Democrats," said the Wall Street Journal. "Congressional oversight is important, but it needs to have a clear public purpose. This is just a trawling expedition to see what nasty details they can dredge up about the president before the 2020 election. Democrats are hoping to bury Trump's presidency in an avalanche of never-ending investigations without actually having to start impeachment hearings, which would backfire with the public. If Democrats truly believe Trump is a threat to the Constitution, they should have the guts to impeach him. Enough with this pseudo-impeachment. what the columnist said. Trump is giving away the game, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. He has claimed that the Mueller report resulted in total exoneration, and his handpicked attorney general insists there was insufficient evidence of obstruction of justice. So why is Trump so terrified of letting Americans hear directly from Mueller himself? The truth is that Mueller actually found that Trump's campaign expected it would benefit electorally from Russia's help and welcomed it. On obstruction, the special counsel established extensive evidence of criminality. The president's anxiety is as much about optics as it is about substance, said Eric Lutz in VanityFair.com. Mueller has real gravitas, and his testimony could be a dramatic and damaging television spectacle, undermining Barr's pro-Trump spin on the report. The Democrats now have their own version of Benghazi, said Jonathan Tobin in TheFederalist.com. After 2 years of hoping that Mueller would take down Trump, only to have him come up short, Democrats are hoping to harass Trump by endlessly relitigating Mueller's investigation and drowning him in other inquiries. It won't work. Trump won an election while refusing to release his tax returns and after being exposed by the Access Hollywood tape as being a self-confessed assaulter of women. What could they possibly find that will change voters' minds now? We can only imagine, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg.com. Trump is the most financially conflicted president of the modern era. Yet the public still knows shockingly little about his business dealings. After he lost more than $1 billion during the 1980s and early 90s, where and how did he find enough money to recover? Not long ago, our president was a mobbed-up, money-hemorrhaging, failed casino operator whose sons have described him as reliant on Russian financing, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Americans have a right to know if the president was bailed out by Russians or any other foreign country. Trump's GOP allies, however, paint all attempts to investigate him as petty politics. Do they really think Trump has nothing to hide? Or would they rather not know? Our controversy of the week, electability, the Democrats' dangerous obsession. So desperate are Democrats to defeat Donald Trump, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post, that they're obsessed with nominating the most electable candidate. That is virtually the only reason former Vice President Joe Biden has jumped out to a large early poll lead over 21 other declared candidates. Few Democratic voters are actually excited about Biden, 76. They just think that enough conservative white males will vote for him to dislodge Trump from the White House. Recent political history shows that this seemingly pragmatic calculation is completely wrong. Establishment moderates chosen for their electability, such as John McCain, John Kerry, Al Gore, Mitt Romney, and Hillary Clinton, all went down to defeat. A 40-something African-American senator with an Arabic middle name won two presidential elections, while in 2016, a completely unelectable reality TV star shocked the world. Electability is a crock, said Alex Perrine in The New Republic. Suffering from PTSD after losing to Trump, Democrats have taught themselves to vote not for what they want, but for what they imagine their more conservative neighbors might want. This is why a retread like Biden is far out in front of dynamic female senators like Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, who even languish behind white male neophytes Beto O'Rourke and Pete Buttigieg. Sorry, this is not a normal election, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. The only way Trump wins in 2020 is by retaining the working class white men in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania who gave him a razor-thin 78,000 vote victory in those key swing states in 2016. Why risk alienating those voters again with a candidate carrying the baggage of left wokeness like Harris or Warren, or a self-described socialist like Bernie Sanders? Given the deep loathing Democrats have for the reckless authoritarian in the White House, turnout should not be a problem. In the midterms, a record number of Democrats flocked to the polls. Indeed, Biden currently is getting more than 40% of the black vote thanks to his deep association with Barack Obama. At the same time, Scranton Joe's authentic working-class roots enable him to connect with non-college-educated white men in the Midwestern states like no other Democrat in this field. If he wins those states, he'll be the next president. White working-class voters aren't looking for a centrist, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. Democrats can only make inroads with that group by offering progressive economic policies so bold and appealing to their self-interest that they set aside the racial resentment that led them to vote for Trump. Who knows what electability really means? Asked Peter Hamby in VanityFair.com. The Democrats' most successful candidates in recent decades have been young outsiders who created excitement about the future. Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. Why should Democrats play it safe with a 70-something white man who failed in two previous presidential bids when they just elected hundreds of women, African Americans, Muslims, and gays to Congress, city halls, and governor's mansions in districts long held by Republicans? Besides, electability can be ephemeral, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. Just ask Rick Perry, the GOP's front runner in the 2012 presidential race, until his infamous oops gaffe. Biden has a long history of gaffes, so no one knows how he'll fare in the crucible of debates and primaries. In presidential races, measures of electability are subject to rapid, dramatic change. And we're up to our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for data recovery after a Taiwanese man accidentally swallowed one of his Apple AirPod earbuds and heard it playing music in his belly. He recovered the device after it passed through his digestive tract and found the AirPod still working with its battery at 41%. It was a good week for low-tech solutions after fire officials announced a plan to release hundreds of goats into the forest and scrubland north of Los Angeles. The goats eat brush, thus diminishing the risk of devastating fires. They're very effective, said Captain Kenneth Van Wig. And it was a good week for finishing second after Country House was declared the winner of the Kentucky Derby by stewards, who ruled that first-place finisher Maximum Security veered in front of other horses and impeded their progress, the first such disqualification in the 145-year history of the race. But it was a bad week for running 26.2 miles, with an admission by the organizers of Ireland's Belfast City Marathon that due to human error, the course for this year's race was 0.293 miles too long. It was a bad week for spelling. After President Trump retweeted a call for him to extend his term in office, explaining in a follow-up tweet that they have stolen 2 years of my, in parentheses, our presidency, and then in parentheses, collusion, delusion. Stollen is a festive German bread containing fruit and nuts. He wrote S-T-O-L-L-E-N instead of S-T-O-L-E-N. And finally, it was a bad week for continuity. After sharp-eyed fans of Game of Thrones, HBO fantasy epic spotted a modern paper coffee cup complete with plastic lid and corrugated cardboard heat sheath sitting on one of the show's medieval banquet tables. We've got a science theme to our briefing page article. It's titled, Billions of Black Holes. The universe is actually filled with these bizarre objects. What do we know about them? How do we know black holes exist? For decades, scientists inferred the existence of black holes by observing the otherwise inexplicable movements of celestial gases and bodies under the influence of their immense gravity. In April, astronomers used an array of radio telescopes to capture the first image of a black hole 55 million light years away in another galaxy. The image shows a pupil-like black circular space ringed by a yellow-red cornea of superheated gases swirling at the edge of the black hole's reach. We have seen what we thought was unseeable, said Shep Dolman, an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity predicted black holes in 1915 and created a framework for understanding them. What exactly is a black hole? It's essentially a puncture in space-time, the fabric of our universe. In Einstein's theory of relativity, time is the fourth dimension, and time and space are interconnected. Gravity isn't truly a force, but a curvature in space-time produced by mass. Think of space-time as the rubber surface of a trampoline, and a black hole as a bowling ball placed on that surface. The ball causes the fabric to sag, drawing smaller objects into the depression. Since black holes are believed to have infinite density, they create bottomless pits in space-time. Astrophysicists don't know where matter that falls into them winds up. How do they form? The concept of a black hole was so radical, Einstein wrongly concluded this phenomenon did not exist in the real world. But science now knows otherwise. They begin when stars exhaust their fuel. At that point, the nuclear fusion reactions that support the star's outer layers cease and no longer prevent its huge mass from collapsing under gravity. The star then explodes in a supernova. Afterward, if the remnant core is about three times as massive as our sun, it collapses with such force that nothing can arrest it. It becomes an infinitely dense point with no volume or a singularity. The gravity is so powerful it will swallow anything, including light, that crosses a boundary called the event horizon. Approaching that boundary is a bit like going over Niagara Falls in a canoe, said the late physicist Stephen Hawking. If you are above the falls, you can get away if you paddle fast enough. But once you are over the edge, you are lost. There's no way back. When were black holes found? In 1971, the astronomer Charles Thomas Bolton discovered the first observational evidence of a black hole. A blue star in our Milky Way galaxy appeared to wobble, suggesting it was under the influence of a very strong gravity source that was not visible. By studying more closely, Bolton found that the star was orbiting a black hole at 200 times the speed of sound. And that black hole, Cygnus X1, was devouring it. How many are there? Billions. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is thought to contain as many as 400 billion stars. Roughly one out of every thousand is sufficiently massive that it will create a black hole after death. That would suggest 400 million black holes in our galaxy alone. A fraction of those are supermassive black holes, a million to a billion times more massive than our sun. Most of the 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe are believed to have such a supermassive black hole at their center. The Milky Way has one, Sagittarius A, with about 4 million times the sun's mass crammed into a space about 30 times the diameter of the sun. What happens at the event horizon? Strange stuff. Consider what would happen if you fell into a black hole yourself. As you approach the black hole, you would speed up enormously and the flow of time would slow. Someone watching you approach the event horizon would never see you cross it. You would appear to slow down and hover just outside, Hawking said. You would get dimmer and dimmer and redder until you were effectively lost from sight. If you approached the black hole feet first, its gravity would pull harder on your shoes than your head, and you'd be stretched and shredded in a process that astrophysicists have dubbed spaghettification. What's inside a black hole? This is a mystery. It is really beyond the physics we know, says Juan Antonio Valiente Kroon, a mathematician at the University of London. To understand what happens inside a black hole, we need to invent new physics. Some suggest a black hole represents a shortcut to another region of our universe, or a portal to a different one. If black holes lead to other universes, it follows the Big Bang might represent the opposite of a black hole from another universe, spewing matter consumed there into our nascent dimension. This might be possible, Hawking said. The hole would need to be large, and if it was rotating, it might have a passage to another universe. But you couldn't come back to our universe. So although I'm keen on space flight, I'm not going to try that. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with "The Economy May Re-elect Trump." If the economy keeps its momentum, said Henry Olson, President Trump is likely to be reelected. The latest job numbers are marvelous. 263,000 jobs added last month, or nearly 50% more than forecast. And the biggest winners are the kind of voters that propelled Trump into office, people without college degrees. Over the past year, the unemployment rate for high school graduates dropped from 4.1% to 3.1%, whereas workers with four-year college degrees thrived disproportionately in the Clinton, Bush, and Obama presidencies. Wages under Trump are increasing at roughly the same rate regardless of education. A new CNN poll found that 56% of Americans approve of Trump's work on the economy. Yet Trump's own approval ratings still haven't reached 50%. Surely because of Trump's own errors. He keeps calling attention to his character, including attacking adversaries and complaining about the Mueller report. Still, political history indicates Trump has a good chance of winning. Voters will have to decide. Do they stick with the guy they've got, warts and all, who has contributed to such good times, or take a chance that a Democrat will screw things up with a new agenda? Reparations would worsen race relations. Democratic presidential candidates are testing the idea of making reparations for slavery an active issue in the 2020 presidential campaign, said Lance Morrow. That's a terrible idea, both politically and practically. Compensation for slavery is an inviting idea in principle, but it raises so many complex and divisive issues that it would make race relations in America a good deal worse. Tens of millions of white Americans would insist that their immigrant forebears arrived in the country after slavery ended and therefore cannot be held responsible for its crimes or its legacy. Indeed, most people who lived in the U.S. in 1860 did not own slaves. And who would get the reparations? Everyone with any African-American ancestors, even if they were 98% white? Should wealthy black people like Oprah Winfrey or Barack Obama, whose father grew up in Africa, get reparations too? As Americans argued over these issues, it would throw open a trapdoor out of which all manner of bigotries and bitterness, all the black bats of American history, would fly. Unfortunately, the only realistic answer to America's ugly racial legacy is continued slow progress. No program of reparations can undo the past or heal its wounds. This column comes from Canada, a land scarred by abandoned wells. Bankrupt oil companies have left their abandoned wells all over Alberta, said Anthony Davis. These orphan wells often sit on farmland because farmers were happy to earn $5,000 a year from a well lease, more than the $600 they'd get from growing crops on the land around each well. They're not so happy when those same oil firms go broke and walk away from the rigs. And some property owners attribute chronic health problems and even deaths to leakages from the abandoned installations. The Orphan Well Association, OWA, a group financed by the oil and gas industry, is tasked with cleaning up the mess. But OWA is extremely overstretched. Years of low oil and gas prices have caused a rising number of energy firms to shutter. Some 300 have left Western Canada since 2014. Right now, of the more than 300,000 wells in Alberta, at least 167,000 are inactive, abandoned, or orphaned. OWA decommissioned only 750 such wells last year. Landowners want oil and gas firms to up their funding for the group so it can work faster. The energy sector has claimed the cleanup will cost $18.5 billion, but internal industry documents suggest the actual price could be as high as $70 billion. Compared with the scale of the problem, the industry's efforts seem puny. The Last Word article this week is titled, A Death in the Desert. In 2016, a controversial killing in Nevada sent a man to prison, said journalist Paige Blackenbuehler in High Country News. The victim? An inch-long devil's hole pupfish. They passed around a bottle of Malibu rum as gunshots bellowed in the desert night. A trio of young men had set up camp near the unincorporated town of Crystal, 80 miles outside of Las Vegas. As recently as 2005, the tiny town hosted two brothels, but by April 2016, it was pretty much empty. Ideal for carefree camping on a moon-like stretch of desert, the perfect place to pass around a bottle and a shotgun for some bunny blasting. As often happens on a night like that, things went downhill. Drunk on rum and the roar of the gun, the three men fired up an off-road vehicle and drove away from camp. Riding in the back was Trent, a chestnut-haired, bearded 27-year-old who carried the shotgun and blasted away at road signs as they tore across the Amargosa Valley and Ash Meadows National Wildlife Refuge. They headed toward a remote unit of Death Valley National Park. Devil's Hole, a deep pool inside a sunken limestone cavern. The area is surrounded by 10-foot-tall fencing, a fortress erected to protect an endangered species of pupfish found there. Trent shot at the gate to the pedestrian walkway area and then shot the surveillance camera and yanked it from its mount. Then he and one of his companions, Stephen, stumbled into the enclosure. Stephen was so intoxicated that it took him multiple tries to clear the fence. Inside the enclosure, he paused to empty his bladder. Filled with mischief, Trent lunged toward his partner and punched him in the crotch with a left hook. Then, as Stephen stumbled over to a larger boulder to vomit, Trent dropped the shotgun, stripped off his clothes, and slipped into the deep, warm water of Devil's Hole. He didn't know it yet, but that would prove to be his worst mistake of the night. 60,000 years ago, a narrow fissure opened up in the Amargosa Valley, releasing water pooled deep on the earth and creating Devil's Hole, the opening to an underwater cavern. Scientists disagree over just how it happened, whether by way of underground tunnels, ancient floods, or receding waters. But several desert fish were separated from the larger population and trapped in Devil's Hole. There, a tiny subpopulation, the Devil Hole pupfish, evolved in extreme isolation for tens of thousands of years, eventually, according to scientific consensus, becoming an entirely new species. Today, visitors to Devil's Hole get a rare window into one of the Mojave Desert's vast aquifers. Steep limestone walls surround a tiny opening into turquoise water. Divers have descended over 400 feet into the cave without reaching the bottom. The water is so deep that earthquakes on the other side of the world cause it to slosh, shocking the fish into spawning. The environment in Devil's Hole is so remote and extreme that scientists have long puzzled over how the pupfish can live there at all. Still, a modest population has managed to survive on a shallow, sloping rock shelf that gets just enough sunlight, only 4 hours per day at its peak, to allow algae to grow for the fish to eat. The Devil's Hole pupfish are truly unique. The males are a bright blue, the females a subdued teal, and they're only about an inch long. Trapped by geology in a consistent 93-degree womb, Devil's Hole pupfish have nowhere to go. In fact, they have the smallest geographic range of any known vertebrate species. The pupfish was among the first species to be protected under the Endangered Species Preservation Act of 1966, along with the American alligator, the California condor, and the blunt-nosed leopard lizard. And that protection was carried over to the Endangered Species Act of 1973. At the time, around 220 survived in Devil's Hole. But since the 1990s, the species has been in significant decline, sinking to just 35 fish in 2013. Today, there are modest signs that the population is growing. The last population count was 136. On Monday, May 2, 2016, Kevin Wilson, an aquatic ecologist and manager of the Devil's Hole Research Program, arrived at the National Park Service outpost in Pahrump, Nevada, a beige low-key building in the middle of anti-fed country. "We have some news you won't like," one of his research associates told him, gesturing toward her computer screen. Wilson peered at the images just as one of the three trespassers tried and failed to clear the fencing before barging his way in on the other side of the enclosure. Normally, the nocturnal visitors would have been caught by a motion sensor that triggered a loud alarm. But a barn owl roosting in the area had caused too many false alarms, and rather than spook the bird, officials had disabled the device. So once the men broke in, they felt no real urgency to leave. Little did they know that multiple cameras captured their every move. The video played in Wilson's office. As one man swam, another remained at the edge of the water, while the drunkest one leaned against a rock. The swimmer climbed out of the water, dragged himself over the algae-covered shelf, and got dressed. Then the men fled on their off-road vehicle. Wilson paused the video and backed it up. The man who fired the shotgun and plunged into the pool had left a few things behind: his wallet and cell phone. The next morning, in the fog of a hangover, he broke into Devil's Hole to retrieve them, ignoring the empty beer cans and his underwear, which were still floating in the water. Wilson reviewed one particular piece of footage, a view from an underwater camera, over and over. A foot plunged through the placid algae-filled water onto a shallow shelf, the only breeding area in the world for the Devil's Hole pupfish. The man had waded in at the most inopportune time, the peak breeding period for the pupfish. "I couldn't immediately tell if any fish were harmed," Wilson told me, "but I decided to do a site visit to find out for sure." That morning, Wilson, his research team, and a bevy of law enforcement officials assessed the damage. The area reeked of vomit, and Trent's underwear still floated in the water. In the pool, a single bright blue pupfish was also floating on the surface, dead. The trespass swiftly activated an intricate enforcement network designed to protect the fish. A task force was assembled, led by the Park Service Investigative Services' Paul Crawford. Crawford would supervise two other men, Morgan Dillon and Josh Van. Dillon, a detective for Nye County Sheriff's Office, jumped at the chance to work on the case. "I originally went to college to be a wildlife biologist," Dillon told me. "I've always been passionate about that and still like to read scientific articles on the pupfish. Me, personally, though, I wasn't smart enough to be a scientist, so I became a detective instead." Abundant surveillance footage gave the detectives clear images of the three suspects' faces. The four-wheeler also stood out: a blue Yamaha Rhino with flamboyant stripes along its doors. It was altered with a second seat, extended roof, skid plates up front. "It wasn't something these guys bought and just drove off the lot," Crawford said. Back at the Nye County Sheriff's Office, Dillon showed his colleague, Sergeant Thomas Klesar, an off-road aficionado, video stills of the customized vehicles. Minutes later, Klesar and Dillon found the vehicle on Craigslist. Dillon used the phone number from the Craigslist ad and a house number in one of the photos of the Yamaha to come up with the owner's name. A photo of the man, Stephen Schwickendorf of Pahrump, matched the Devil's Hole footage. On May 6, Dillon, Klesar, and Van drove to Schwickendorf's home. Dark-haired, 6 feet tall, and topping 200 pounds, Schwickendorf answered the door, his arms crossed. A small boy, his son, peeked around his legs. Dillon showed the photos from the surveillance video and asked him if the vehicle was his. Schwickendorf admitted that it was and explained that he had already traded it in as part of a deal for a new four-wheeler. "Is this you?" Dillon asked, pointing to one of the men on the video, according to the investigation transcripts. Schwickendorf said it was. The other two suspects had come to his house for a barbecue before they went camping, he said. "We had been drinking quite a bit," Schwickendorf admitted. Schwickendorf identified his companions, Edgar Reyes, a Las Vegas local, and Trenton Sargent, the skinny dipper, and gave Dillon their phone numbers. Trent Sargent turned himself in just after Memorial Day and pleaded guilty to violating the Endangered Species Act, destruction of federal property, and, because he had been convicted of grand theft of money and property 3 years earlier in San Bernardino, California, possessing a firearm while a felon. Before his sentencing, he submitted a letter to U.S. District Judge Andrew Gordon, who would decide his fate. "I'm not one to make excuses for what I have done wrong, and I'm not going to start now," he wrote in all capitalized slanted script. I made a stupid mistake. I'm not a bad person, Your Honor, and I take full responsibility for my actions and the crimes I committed. On October 25th, 2018, Sargent was sentenced to a total of 12 months and one day, 9 months specifically for his violation of the Endangered Species Act, in the custody of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Once he is released from the Los Angeles Metropolitan Detention Center, Sargent must pay nearly $14,000 in restitution to the National Park Service, along with a $1,000 fee. He's also forbidden to enter federal public lands for the rest of his life. 4 months later, I journeyed to Indian Springs, Nevada, a community of fewer than 1,000 where Sargent has lived for most of his life. It's home to Creech Air Force Base and the Desert Warfare Training Center. I met Sargent's family at their spacious and warmly lit double-wide manufactured home. His mother, Noreen, sat outside watching her grandchildren jump on a trampoline in the yard. Trent's father, Josh, joined us a few minutes later, home from work at the Nevada National Nuclear Security Site. I had assumed that the Sargent family would consider what happened to their son unfair, but I was wrong. In fact, they defended the Endangered Species Act with a conviction that surprised me, and they knew a lot about Devil's Hole and the pupfish that swam in it. Noreen recalled the family taking trips there when Trent was a boy. Trent would just as soon give first aid and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to that little pupfish than to have this thing go on, Josh said. The sergeant's home was filled with pictures of family. In one, the beaming 12-year-old Trent holds up the first fish he ever caught, a minuscule rainbow trout. But now Trent can't visit public lands or use a firearm. Trent grew up hunting and fishing, Noreen said, and now he'll never get to go hunting with his dad ever again. Because there are so many endangered species, society is forced to make difficult choices about which ones to protect and to what lengths we should go to save them. Climate change has quickened the pace of extinction, and already the number of critically endangered species exceeds our ability to save them all. The Devil's Hole pupfish, serene, obscure, and tiny, has survived a very long time in an unkind place, just one drunken night or one jug of poison away from oblivion. It is a wonder, to be sure, but how far do you go to save a species like this? Since the incident, Devil's Hole has become an even more formidable fortress. The Park Service capped its towering fences with additional barbed wire. The public can view the sunken cave only from a distance now, more than 20 feet above it. And inside the fenced viewing area are even more cameras, motion sensors, and no trespassing signs. "I hate it," Wilson told me this winter. "I hear from the public all of the time. Why does this place look like a prison? People get really upset that they can't get a closer look. But it's just what we have to do, to stop people from doing stupid things." This was adapted from an article that first appeared in High Country News. They have what they call a special report this week that I thought you might enjoy. It's about a one-page article, and it's titled "Secrets of Longevity: The Lessons We Can Draw from the World's Centenarian Havens." Where in the world do people live longest? People have searched for and dreamed of regions of extraordinary longevity for centuries, as far back as Jonathan Swift's fictional island of Lugnag in Gulliver's Travels. In the 1960s, the pioneering nutritionist Ansel Keys drew attention to long lives and low rates of heart disease in parts of Italy and the island of Crete. Though his recommendations, which urged a carb-heavy Mediterranean diet, are now controversial, Keys helped spark a more systematic search for locals with remarkable lifespans. About 15 years ago, the explorer and writer Dan Buettner and his team at National Geographic pinpointed five such places. Loma Linda, California, Nicoya, Costa Rica, Sardinia, Italy, Ikaria, Greece, and Okinawa, Japan. Residents of those areas, which Butner called blue zones, made it to their 100th birthday at 10 times the rate of the general U.S. population. So what sets the blue zones apart? After analyzing all the data, Butner and his colleagues zeroed in on 9 contributing factors. Keeping physically active, maintaining a sense of purpose and drive, taking time to relax or play, avoiding overeating, following a plant-based diet, drinking wine, participating in a faith-based community, having close family ties, and staying social. In all 5 blue zones, centenarians ate a plant-based diet made up largely of whole grains, greens, potatoes, nuts, and legumes. They ate meat on average only 5 times a month, and wine was consumed moderately, 1 to 2 glasses a day. For blue zone residents, being physically active meant leading lives in which they were almost always moving. They walked whenever they could and did yard work without motorized conveniences like lawn tractors. What about genetics? It plays a role, but not as much as you might think. Multiple family studies have shown that for most of us, our genetic makeup probably accounts for only about 20 to 30% of our longevity. In fact, research has shown that healthy lifestyle choices such as diet, exercise, and social interactions can actually override genetic predispositions to certain conditions, such as heart disease or diabetes, thereby extending our healthy span too. That said, when a 2011 in the Journal of American Geriatric Society looked at the early BMIs, calorie intake, physical activity, alcohol use, and smoking habits of a group of seniors aged 95 and older, they found little difference between their behavior and those of the general population who didn't live as long. So it appears that the genetic makeup of a lucky few may be robust enough to delay their aging process regardless of their lifestyle decisions. What if my life takes place mainly indoors? Luckily for those of us who spend most of our days at work indoors, research shows that regular exercise in or out of the gym can provide life-lengthening results. For example, a 2017 study found that for every hour spent running, a person can increase life expectancy by 7 hours. One British study of 1,655 men in their 70s, 80s, and early 90s found that even a half hour of light activity a week cut the chance of dying during the 6 years of the study by 17%. And a recent study of more than 8,500 adults suggests that group sports are perhaps the most longevity-inducing of all. Playing tennis added 9.7 years to participants' lives, badminton 6.2, and soccer 4.7. The researchers suspect that the social aspects of team sports provide a bonus stress-reducing effect, amplifying the benefits of the exercise. Why do social ties matter? Social activity seems to lower stress across the board. When researchers followed nearly 7,000 people over a 9-year period, they found that those with more social ties tended to live longer regardless of other influencing factors such as socioeconomic status, exercise, and body weight. In fact, the mortality rate of men and women with the fewest close relationships was 2.3 and 2.8 times greater, respectively, than that of people with the most. The researchers surmise that having good friendships and strong family ties helps calm our stress response system. Chronically high levels of stress hormone cortisol can suppress our immune system, increasing our risk of life-threatening conditions such as heart disease and type 2 diabetes. Will any of this help my mind stay agile too? Yes, all of it. Studies have found that regular exercise, a plant-based diet, staying active socially, and maintaining close relationships can all have protective effects on the aging brain as well, by improving cognitive function or slowing any decline. Getting good quality sleep is also key. Researchers show that people who regularly sleep less than the recommended 7 to 8 hours a night score lower on tests of mental function. Finally, keep cultivating a sense of purpose. Stay active in your church, take classes, volunteer. Two new studies show that not only can this protect against cognitive decline, but it can also boost happiness. And we'll finish out the show on the Talking Points page, starting with the article, Semenya, is testosterone an unfair advantage? South African sprinter Caster Semenya has won 2 Olympic gold medals and 30 consecutive 800-meter sprints and dominated her sport. Now she's the subject of one of the biggest controversies the track and field world has seen, said Rick Mace in the Washington Post. Last week, a court overseeing the International Association of Athletics Federation, the IAAF, ruled that intersex athletes like Semenya, 28, who naturally produce high levels of testosterone, cannot compete in several types of women's track events unless they artificially reduce those levels. Testosterone can create larger, stronger muscles. In denying her appeal, the court acknowledged its ruling was discriminatory, but said such discrimination is a necessary, reasonable, and proportionate means of achieving the IAAF's aim of preserving the integrity of female athletics. This ruling is based on the now disproven myth that gender is binary, said Ariana Njung Cha, also in the Post. Science now knows that as many as 1 in 60 people are intersex, with physical characteristics that don't match our traditional views of male and female. But the IAAF and many women runners Semenya has trounced refuse to accept her as she is. For me, she is not a woman, Italian runner Elisa Kusma complained. She is a man. How unfair, said Nancy Armour in USA Today. Semenya did not choose this condition any more than Michael Phelps chose his inordinately wide wingspan, or a 7'3" basketball center chose his body. And yet we cheer their biological advantages and penalize hers. There's a good reason to classify athletes by gender, said Jonathan Galt in Let'sRun.com. In track and field, top male athletes consistently are about 10% faster than top female athletes. And in its ruling, the court stated that the IAAF's testosterone restrictions apply only to female athletes with XY chromosomes, that is, the same kind that men have. This indicates Semenya has male chromosomes and internal testes as well as high levels of testosterone. Is this really fair to other women runners? To put that question in perspective, consider this. Though intersex people are rare, it's believed that all 3 medalists from the 2016 Olympic women's 800-meter final are intersex, Semenya included. If that doesn't make you understand from a simple odds perspective that there needs to be a limit on testosterone in women's sports, then I don't know what will. Facebook, the banning of extremists. Some cheered it as the righteous booting of a bunch of high-profile bigots, said April Glazer in Slate.com. Others denounced it as a tyrannical act of corporate censorship. Facebook caused a furor last week by permanently banning from its platform 7 people it branded dangerous individuals who promote or engage in violence and hate. Among the evicted were conspiracy theorist and InfoWars founder Alex Jones, who claimed the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting was a hoax staged by gun control advocates. His deputy, Paul Joseph Watson, was ousted for videos such as Why Are Feminists Fat and Ugly? Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, a notorious anti-Semite, was purged. So was far-right provocateur Laura Loomer, who has called Islam a cancer on society and advocated banning Muslims from holding public office in the U.S. In response, President Trump chose to play the victim card, said Charles Sykes in TheBulwark.com. He lashed out at Facebook with a fusillade of tweets accusing it of targeting conservatives. This is the United States of America, he railed, and we have what's known as freedom of speech. How ironic. It was Trump, of course, who said NFL owners should fire black players who knelt in protest during the national anthem. Yet he is now championing and often retweets alt-right charlatans who traffic in hoaxes, fraud, fabrication, smears, and bigotry. The reality is that no one has the right to free speech on Facebook, said S.E. Cupp in CNN.com. Facebook is a private company and under no constitutional obligation to provide a platform to bigots and cranks. That said, I'd rather keep the Nazis living next door, expressing themselves in the open, rather than banishing them to underground chat rooms and the nether regions of the Internet. No one will miss the rogues gallery of despicable people Facebook banned, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. But it won't always be so easy to draw distinct lines between normal discourse on social media and hate speech. What about student critics of Israel or military anti-immigrant activists? Do you trust Mark Zuckerberg and the other young lords of Silicon Valley to be good stewards of the world's digital speech? I don't. As Facebook's serial scandals show, the tech wizards lack the wisdom, experience, and humility to exercise their awesome power responsibility. Now that the banning has begun, prepare for unintended consequences. With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.